Accession number 7396, reel number 14.
Colonel Hancock, reel 14. You were telling me about the Russian reaction to your plans for telephone lines.
Well, yes, it was really rather amusing. We submitted a very carefully detailed plan as to where we were going to reroute some telephone wires. And we submitted this to the Russians for their approval, let them know what was going on, which was fair enough. And they replied, "Oh, thank you very much for your plans. It was very nice. But that, of course, is not what you're going to do, is it? Would you let us know what you're really going to do?" And that was the kind of attitude that they took up. They were absolutely, they couldn't believe that anybody would ever tell the truth first time. Just a sidelight on the kind of attitude that they assumed all the time. It's very difficult to work with.
How did you get on with the Americans?
Well, I wouldn't say... I think half the difficulty was that we spoke, I wouldn't say the same language, but we didn't have to work use an interpreter. Their way of life and their outlook on the army life and ours were absolutely totally different. They seemed to take, we noticed, over they had their own welfare arrangements, and we noticed that we could always arrive at our objective long before they did. They seemed to do so much talking and discussing and smoking cigars and shaking hands in one another's office, and they would arrive at some god hour in the morning and spend about an hour talking of this and that. They were there. They never would ever leave their office if somebody else was still there. And they went on at night, no matter whether they got anything to do or not. They just were peer busy. And we found that the practical things that we did were got there much more quickly.
What were the relationships like between the British and American troops? Did they rub along together?
I didn't see very much of the American troops. But on the whole, it was a difficult situation. We were known as integrated. That is to say, the head of each department would be American, then the next would be English, then the next American. Or in another department, the head of the department would be English, then American, then English. And it worked up to a point. But it wasn't really very happy.
Did you ever visit the Reichstag?
Oh, yes. After some time, after I'd been there and we were able to find our way about, incidentally I had a jolly nice Humber car and a driver that I was able to get about with, otherwise I couldn't possibly have done my job. Yes, I went to the Reichstag once there to see, really out of curiosity. And of course in there it was absolutely extraordinary the amount of damage that the Russians had managed to do. The Russians, after very, very severe fighting in capturing Berlin, had a very rough time, no doubt about it. And they were just let loose. And they must have behaved like animals. There wasn't a single thing that wasn't sabotaged or vandalized in some way or other. All wall brackets were torn out by brute force out of the wall. Every basin was smashed. Hitler's marvelous desk, some 12 feet long and 9 inches thick, had been overturned and smashed to bits. And I suppose it gave them a vast satisfaction to do that sort of thing, but it was animal-like. And everything was, all the drawers were pulled out, chucked on the floor, goodness knows what. I got one or two medals that I picked up just out of curiosity and one or two things. But it was really rather depressing to feel that so much energy should be wasted on all that devastation. But that was typical of the Russians' attitude.
At what point were you demobilised?
That came about the middle of August. But before I left, there were one or two parades of English and American troops in Berlin, which I must say I was very proud to see. It was the sort of the final, we felt, defeat, I suppose, of the German and the army. We felt, we all felt, that at last they really had been beaten, and they're on their knees, largely through starvation. They had a terrible time, from our bombers, and they were absolutely out. And these parades, I must say, was marvellous for our troops. And as I say, that was very satisfactory. And the Major General Lyne, who commanded the 7th Armoured Division all through the North African campaign, he took a salute. And that was most impressive. Well, then a time came when my tour of duty had to end, and I handed over to my second command, John Scott, and who I hadn't every reason to believe would carry on all our work very well. And eventually I left there about mid-August. I went by train from there to some rest camp not so very far away, and from there the next morning we went by train to Ostend, and there we went to I've forgotten what they call it, some kind of camp there, but I in fact put up at the Guards Division Club there, the I Club, which is rather nice. Next day we crossed over to Folkestone, got a train to London. I went to Regent's Park, of all places, to be actually demobilised, where I'd been serving all that long time before. And there I got my demobilisation papers. I was sent down to Olympia, where I was fitted out with a civilian outfit of clothes. And there, I must say, they were very good, and I wore them for years after. But that was the end of the army for me. And I then made my way back to my home in Warwickshire.
I'd now like to really take you back to the beginning again, because you are now president of the Gallipoli Association, which is an association formed to commemorate the Gallipoli landings of 1915. Could you tell me a little about your role in the Gallipoli Association?
Well, I joined the association not all that long time ago, and it came about because I read a letter in the Daily Telegraph written by the founder of the Gallipoli Association, Major Edgar Banner. And he was drawing attention to the fact that there was such an association. I'd never heard of it before. I'd thought of Gallipoli for many, many years. And I suddenly thought, my word, that's jolly nice. I must find out about that. I rang him up straight away. I had a word with him about it. I heard from him very shortly afterwards. He sent me an entry form. I then joined the association, which was about 2 or 3 years ago, I suppose. And it was just a sheer piece of luck that I happened to see that letter in the Telegraph. Anyway, I joined the association. I went to the various functions which we have, and then I was asked a little bit later on if I'd be appointed as a vice president, which I said I would. And shortly after that, not very long after that, our president, who was Admiral Longley Cook, died. He'd been ill for a long time. And I was asked if I'd take over the presidency, which, of course, I was very glad to do, although I felt a bit diffident, not having belonged to the association for very long. Anyway, the object of the association is to keep in touch members of the armed forces who were in Gallipoli, and to keep alive the memory of those of their comrades who lost their lives. We have two functions during the year, one on Anzac Day, that is the 25th of April, when the Australian and New Zealand commissioners have a ceremony at the London Cenotaph, at which we are asked, as an association, we are invited to attend, and we lay a wreath for the association. Following that, we go to a special Anzac Day service in Westminster Abbey, which is a lovely service. The Abbey is absolutely packed with people, and it's very moving. Usually an address is made by someone from either Australia or New Zealand. After that, we go down to, the last two or three years, we've been going down to Chelsea Barracks, where we have a lunch, and we're very kindly invited to go down to the officers' mess there. After we've had lunch, we have our AGM, not a very rather informal affair, but it's very nice for us to get together. And not a great many people are able to make it. Somebody's got to travel a long way, and so that we don't, as a rule, get many than 40 or 50 people. But it's a very nice time to do. The other annual meeting is a dinner which we had in the autumn, and for some years now we've had it at the Royal Air Force Club in Piccadilly. And there we can invite a guest of honour. Last year we had the High Commissioner for New Zealand, and this year we shall have the High Commissioner for Australia as our guest of honour. We have also other official guests, and we have a very pleasant evening. It's very, again, informal. We like to hear views of members about what's going on, what they would like the association to do. We're always wanting to know about that. And now, of course, we're looking to our associate members. Now, it was originally for people who had been in Gallipoli. There are also associate members, that is to say, people who, parents or who relations of some kind had been there, or have got some close relationship with the history of the campaign or something like that. And we look to them now to carry on the association in the future. We don't want it to die out. It was largely because the 29th Division, who had all that fighting in Cape Helles, it was largely because the 29th Division Association folded up. It was largely through that Edgar Banner conceived the idea of starting the Gallipoli Association, and we're very grateful to him.
I believe you actually visited Gallipoli yourself recently, last year in 1983.
Yes, I did.
I'd just like to know how you felt on your return to the beach you landed on 70 years ago. I mean, what sort of feelings did you have? Was it as you expected? Was it as you remembered?
The physical features were exactly as I thought about it for many, many years. Exactly. And it was a beach. I could see no difference in the general aspect at all, except that the level ground at Suvla, inland from Suvla, had all been cultivated, and it was beautifully done. When we landed there, it was nothing but a scruffy-looking, rough ground covered in scrub and apparently useless. Now they've managed to get the irrigation working well, and they've cultivated it marvellous with all modern machinery, right down to combine harvesters. And they grow lovely crops of vegetables, fruit, lots of fruit has been planted, corn of all kinds.
Did you manage to find the trenches you were in at Hill 60?
Yes, I did. I did. It was a bit nostalgic, to say the least, at first. We went to my son, Michael, and I. He'd financed us, incidentally. He and I really went to visit the war cemeteries there, of which there are 31, all beautifully kept by Turkish gardeners under the War Graves Commission. They were all beautifully done. I must say, the first one or two I went to, I felt a bit choky. But I got over that, and I was, in fact, able to identify the very place where that mine was exploded under the front line of the Turkish trenches on Hill 60, opposite Hill 60, which I talked about earlier. I found that, and the cemetery had been built right on top of where the Hill 60 trenches were. Having found that mine crater, which is still there, I was able to retrace 25 to 30 paces, and I found just the faint indentations of our front line and one machine gun post, which I knew where it was, and there in Jolliver was. That was somehow or other, it was a, after all those years, it was rather a relief to have actually seen it again. I sort of, it is like, almost like laying a ghost, if you know what I mean. And I felt it was very satisfying to have done that. And that was my the most vivid memory I have of the revisit there. No, we had a wonderful 3 days on the peninsula there, going around these war graves and talking to the local war graves organizer. The Turkish people, you know, they were jolly good hard fighters, but they're a gentle country folk in the country. They're nice people, and they're completely honest. The War Graves Commission organised said, "Well, you can leave anything lying about. Everything's perfectly safe here. Nobody will pinch anything." Well, you could hardly do that in England.
On that note, I think we'll leave it. Colonel Hancock, thank you very much.